Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Space Jams podcast. I am your host, Jim Murphy, and today we have a very special guest, a space historian, Dr. John Logsdon. Dr. John Logsdon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Yes, and we are very excited to have you here. I've used your book for my thesis, and so it's very awesome to get to speak with you and pick your brain about some of the things you've talked about. First, a brief introduction. Dr. John Logsdon is a professor emeritus of political science and international affairs at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He was the founder in 1987 and longtime director of GW's Space Policy Institute. He has also been a faculty member of the International Space University since 1989. He holds a BS in physics from Xavier University and a PhD in political science from New York University. He's also written several books, of which I have used for many projects, and he is going to sprinkle in other wonderful things along the way as we get along here. Professor, how are we doing? I'm very excited to talk to you. I think my first question, which seems like a simple question, but I think it's important, is why is space history an important study or important field of study?
Well, because space is an important area of human activity. After all, in the years since we've been putting objects in space, since 1957, we, the human race, the United States since 1958, it's changed the world in many ways, from sending 12 Americans to walk on another celestial body between 1969 and 1972, to the kind of data links that make this conversation possible. So the capability to operate in space has been a fundamental change agent to human history over the past now more than a half a century. And recording how it was done, how people have thought about it, what decisions drove the programs in various directions, I think all of that is worth doing.
And I think when it comes to history, a lot of history that we've studied takes place a very long time ago. But the interesting thing about space history is, other than astronomy, is that it's very recent history, actually. It's, 80 years ago, 60 years ago. And it makes it almost difficult to study it, because there's not so much written about it. And that has been my experience. And how does that make, how do you feel about that? That it's such a recent history?
There's some criticism that what me and my colleagues do is not legitimate history, because it's not done at a distance from the events as they happen. And it's more kind of fancy journalism. I more or less reject that as a meaningful distinction, tracking how things happened. My particular focus are the presidential decisions that have driven the U.S. human spaceflight program. And the documents are in the archives. Most of the people involved that I have interacted with in tracing Kennedy, Nixon, Reagan's space decisions have passed away, not all of them, fortunately. So I think it is legitimate history. I should say, you said it even in your introduction, I think my doctorate was in political science, not history. And so really what I'm doing is political history. It is policy history. And people 100, 200 years from now may be writing about these same events with more hindsight, but I think it's worth doing it close to the events.
I definitely agree. And I think one of the primary benefits of doing that is you're also living in the era of when it's happening. And
I'll give you an example. I did my PhD dissertation at New York University in late 60s. on Kennedy's decision to go to the moon. I had the manuscript more or less done by 1969, and I got to go to the Apollo 11 launch. I mean, to see happen what you've been writing about is really something remarkable.
Wow, that's incredible, because I was just telling you how it's incredible that I got to read what you wrote, and I used your writing in my thesis, and then now we're speaking, and that's kind of similar.
Yeah.
It's very similar, and it is a great feeling to get to see something come to fruition, which is very cool.
Well, and get to know the people involved all the way through. The Apollo 11 crew became good friends. Look, I could have specialized in environmental policy and gone to look at dead fish. I'm glad I chose the space route.
And on your website, you said that the Apollo 11 crew became like good friends. On your website, you have pictures of you and Neil Armstrong, I believe, and you and Michael Collins on there. Where you did you say you were friends with them, or they became friends?
Well, Mike Collins, as he wrote his book Carrying the Fire, described the Apollo 11 crew as amiable strangers. They were not. The three of them, certainly at the time of the mission, big buddies. I mean, all the astronauts hung out together, but they were three very different personalities. But my point is, I got to know each of them separately over the years fairly well. Neil, the least of the three, Buzz's son, Buzz Aldrin's son, Andy, was one of my students in the 1980s. Buzz used to show up at GW once in a while. So, I've known a lot of the space flyers since then. So, it's neat to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think part of the allure to this podcast for me is getting to know people like you and people like those astronauts and hearing from them and what they have to say and their experiences. And I think that's kind of the same drive I have for getting into this field of incredible people. I think the other question that has to be asked is, why should people care about space history? Why is it important? Why should the general public care, or should they care? Is it more of a, an academic thing to look at?
Well, number one, I mean, there's not really a field called space history. It's history of contemporary affairs. And one of those contemporary affairs is humanity's movement off the surface of this planet, doing things in near Earth orbit and beyond. So again, because the impact of using space, of doing things in space, has been so widespread and significant to the past half century or more of human history. I think knowing why it happened and how it happened is not a trivial pursuit.
And I may be obviously I'm a space person, and I may be believe in more than other people, but one thing for me is why I think this whole situation is important, because there's a lot of people today that don't believe we're going to go to Mars. And even in the 1960s, we wanted to go to Mars, and there were certain things that didn't work out and why we haven't gone yet. But people today don't believe we will go to Mars. But based on what I've seen historically and how we're moving now, I can't believe they don't understand that we're not going to go to, that we are going to go to Mars, maybe within our lifetime.
Well, your lifetime anyway. But consider the dates. On December the 14th, 1972, so 48 plus years ago, the last two people left the moon. No one's been back for nearly half a century. So, most of the people alive have not been alive when anybody has gone beyond low Earth orbit, gone beyond the 250 miles orbit of the space station. So, I mean, there is a sense that actual human travel into deep space, back to the moon, which is kind of our nearby neighbor, and then out to Mars is likely to continue to be science fiction. I think once we return to the moon, I mean, NASA's line right now is the first woman and the next man back to the moon sometime in the 2020s. The idea of going beyond the moon to eventually the only other really credible destination for human travel in any reasonable time frame is Mars. People talk about going to the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, but that's a long, long time in the future. So I think it is the moon, Mars, maybe visiting asteroids. You can't really land on an asteroid because there's not enough gravity to keep you stuck there once you land, or at least near Earth asteroids. So it's moon and the Mars. Mars, I hope the people that will be the first to go to Mars are alive now. But I really expect it to be 2 decades from now or so. So, it's a way off.
I think it's important to have people like Buzz Aldrin is a very, he's huge with Mars. He's very into going to Mars. And so is Colonel TJ Creamer, the astronaut we had on previously, but they're both big about going to Mars. And I think that those types of influences are important. Also, I know you do a lot with presidential policy and presidents' actions in space can lead to advancements. And I believe for the first time ever in President Trump's inauguration speech, he mentioned Mars and how we're going to go there. Do you think that has any impact on going to Mars, that the president said we're going to go there?
Well, eventually, if some president who has more than one term says so, but let me, I'm the historian, you're still the student. George H.W. Bush, on the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11, that is July the 20th, 1989, gave a speech in which he said, back to the moon, this time, this day, then on to Mars. So Mars has been a destination in most presidential, every presidential statement, one way or another, since 1989. Between Kennedy in 1961 and Bush in 1989, no president said we should go back to the moon or on to Mars. But every president except Bill Clinton since 1989 has said at least go back to the moon. Barack Obama said, well, skip the moon. We've been there, done that. Let's just go first to asteroids and then on to Mars. So, exploration, moon or Mars, has been a destination in presidential rhetoric for the last, 90, the last 20 plus years. But we're still waiting to go. And the book I'm working on now is trying to answer the question, why are we waiting? Why has it been so long? Even though presidents have said go, the country or the world hasn't gone. I think that's not history. That's currently the policy debate, is whether we should continue with a program of human exploration. I think Mr. Biden will do that. I hope he will do that, but we'll see.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'll be very interested to read that, because if it's been around for the last 20 years, if it's been in the conversation, why haven't we gone? And I think that's super interesting. Well, I think one thing is, why did we no longer focus on the moon after the Apollo missions?
Well, I think part of it, and this is a thought I'm working out on my own now, I think by declaring going to the moon as a race, John Kennedy laid the seeds sowed the seeds of not continuing. Because once you won the race, once the United States was first to the moon, there was no other politically powerful reason to keep going. And Richard Nixon recognized that. Nobody presented a reason to him that was politically convincing. And so Nixon said, well, we're going to stop. As Apollo 17 left the moon in December of 72, he issued a statement saying, this is the last time in the century that people will walk on the surface of the moon. And by the decisions he made that forecast become reality.
And I'm not certain, but I believe Nixon, Nixon canceled the last three Apollo missions that were scheduled, but he also he started the funding for the shuttle programs.
Right.
Yeah. And I believe you wrote a paper that said the shuttle programs was a failure, question mark. And
I'm not too popular in Houston because of my critique of the shuttle. What I said was that the shuttle was a policy mistake. Mm. Not a technologically, it was a marvelous vehicle. It could do remarkable things. But building a whole program around an experimental vehicle, a first generation vehicle, operating under the illusion that it could be operated routinely and inexpensively was a mistake, because it never had the capabilities of doing that. So it's the shuttle, after all, could only go up 200 to 300 miles. Almost by definition ended exploration, because it was not an exploration vehicle. It was a low Earth orbit vehicle. Nixon wanted to keep human spaceflight alive. He saw the prestige benefits of having astronauts in space, but he was not convinced that continued exploration, particularly extensive exploration of the moon or initial voyages to Mars, were worth the money they would cost, or the public support that basically he judged wasn't there. So he said, you know, enough is enough. He gloried in the accomplishments of Apollo 11, but within a few months he said, I don't see any reason to keep going.
Interesting. So he opted out of going back to the moon and further exploration because did he see the value in the shuttle and near Earth advancements, I suppose, and like satellites and things? Or was there a benefit, or was it just because he wanted to keep the space program alive?
Well, I guess I should say it's a complex story, and your listeners should read the book called After Apollo, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program. But in short form, Nixon wanted to continue human spaceflight. He believed that the astronauts were American heroes and represented the best in American values. And then he was convinced that there were some interesting things that the shuttle could do. Some of them most people don't know about or pay attention to, like intercept other country satellites, inspect them, and if they were hostile, destroy them. The shuttle had anti-satellite capability. It could fly a camera on a one-orbit mission, in principle, and take a picture or images of what was going on someplace in the world and bring them back. In one report, the shuttle was going to land at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington and rush the images to the White House. Nixon was intrigued by some of the shuttle capabilities. And then finally, and I think bottom line, it produced jobs in states that were critical to Nixon's 1972 reelection. He told John Ehrlichman, discussing whether to go forward with the shuttle, jobs, that's what it's about. Nobody gives a damn about a shuttle. It's jobs. put it in California. That's where the jobs are. So that's the start of NASA becoming, among other things, a jobs program, a high technology jobs program. So there was a complex of reasons why Nixon approved the shuttle. There was no long-term vision of space achievement or space exploration behind it. It was kind of short-term politics.
Interesting. Yeah. And I believe that, you know, a president definitely has a great influence on outer space advancement in the U.S. I believe that. Would you say that is also true?
Well, I don't think you're going to initiate in this country a major human space undertaking without the initiative coming first from the president. Kennedy did it more or less on his own. I mean, he had Lyndon Johnson canvass the Congress and say, will I have political support for this if I propose it? But it was a Kennedy decision. I think the decisions since then have involved Congress to a greater degree. The hardware we're building now, for example, the Space Launch System and the Orion capsule were mandated by Congress over the objections of the White House and over the objections of NASA in 2010. And so I think it's more a partnership between the president and the Congress, and particularly with this jobs aspect to the program, congressmen have districts. Senators have states, representatives have districts. And so the people that support the funding for NASA in the Congress are largely those with NASA contracts or NASA installations in their districts. Understanding the political dynamics underpinning the program now is very different than it was in the Nixon and Kennedy and Nixon period.
And we've said before on the show, it's our belief that you have to give the people a rousing speech, a inspirational speech, and then give Congress a check, give them something, some incentive to get going into space. And that's kind of seems like what you're talking
Congress,
about.
Congress writes the check after all. Yeah. So you got to give them a reason to write the check.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I kind of disagree with that, Jim, in current period. We've been preparing to go back to the moon since 2004. George W. Bush, January the 14th, 2004, in the aftermath of the Columbia accident, said it's time for a new vision, a return to the moon, he said, by 2020. I would argue, even though the program has had lots of ups and downs and slowdowns and speed ups, that basically we have been spending billions of dollars per year now for 16 years getting ready to go back to the moon. The finish line is more or less in sight. And all of that is done without major presidential speeches and certainly done without broad public support. It just comes out of the normal year-by-year decisions on how much money to give to NASA and for what. And so we have not really been arguing since 2004. Whether to go beyond Earth orbit. We've been arguing about where to go and how fast to go.
Interesting. And so I was reading, and it said the Columbia Accident Investigation Board observed in 2003 that NASA has become an organization straining to do too much with too little. Is this still the case, or do you think that we've progressed past this?
Well, the first thing to say is I wrote those lines.
That's true.
I was on the Columbia Accident Investigation Board in 2003 as the resident historian, historical memory for the board. So
that's so cool.
I obviously think that it was right then and still right now. Every look at NASA over the past, since 1990, there was a review headed by then the head of Lockheed Martin, Norm Augustine. And every review of the program in the past 30 years has said it needs about 10 or 15% a year more money, $2, $3 billion a year to match expectations of what it's supposed to be doing. So yes, I think NASA is still, taking good example is the current policy, the Trump policy and the Mike Pence policy, is that the next mission to land on the lunar surface is 2024. To do that, one would have to build a human landing system, and there's no money, or very little money, in the current budget to build that system. So here's an expectation. The Trump administration, to its credit, asked for an extra $3 billion to fund the landing system, and the Congress said no, and is still saying no. NASA's budget for the next fiscal year is not passed yet. No, even the current fiscal year. But so, you know, there's an expectation, a goal, but not the money to meet that goal. And that's been a persistent problem.
Has the influx of private space and commercial space companies kind of made it easier for NASA to have less of a budget and to do the same things that it's supposed to do?
No, I don't think so. For some, again, fairly complicated reasons. First of all, Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin, has not done anything in space yet. It has grand plans, and there are plans that will come to culmination in the next few years. Blue Origin's building a new first stage rocket engine, the BE-7, I think it's called, and United Launch Alliance, Lockheed Martin, are waiting for that engine for their next launch vehicle. And then Bezos heads a consortium to build one of the lunar landing systems, but that's not funded. So, downstream, if Bezos does some of the things he says he wants to do, it could relieve pressure on the NASA budget. Now, Elon Musk is a different question because SpaceX is doing things. But some of the things they're doing with NASA funding. like the Crew Dragon and the Cargo Dragon that are carrying humans and supplies to the space station, are funded by NASA. So that's a tax on the NASA budget, if you want. Now, Elon is building with his own money this Starship, which is the big rocket. It's almost as big as the shuttle. It's as tall as the shuttle. That is his vehicle for carrying 100 people or more, first to the moon and then to Mars. And so if that happens, then you question why NASA needs its systems to get people to Mars. But it hadn't happened yet. If he's successful, then it will raise a question of why have government systems when you can buy a launch for whatever reasons the government wants that launch to go to the moon or send people into deep space. So, the interaction between what SpaceX does with NASA and in parallel with NASA over the next 10 years or so, it should be very interesting.
So when it comes to space commercialization, do you think that they should be viewed as a partner? So when it comes to space used to be nations going into space, and now there are private entities that can do it. And that, I believe that started with the Reagan administration and Space Services Incorporated and the Conestoga One. and it's built off from there. And they've generally just been, they sent satellites into space. That's kind of what they were doing. But now they've become like Elon Musk's SpaceX and eventually Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic. Like, should these companies be viewed or be involved in creating the policy, just like nations?
Well, I mean, they are partnering with government. They're consultant with government. So I think what is likely going forward are public-private partnerships in all phases of space activity, including exploration. And nobody's figured out, there are a lot of projections, but nobody's really provided any evidence yet that you could make money with exploration. And that's what the private sector is in business to do, is make money. You know, it's worth, almost as a sidebar, noting that both Elon and Bezos, less, I think, Richard Branson, but Bezos and Musk are also visionaries. And their visions for the future in space are more driven by personal visions, which they want to finance using the revenue from their commercial success, than they are visions of the future where there's a lot of money to be made. I don't think either Musk or Bezos claim that their visions are going to be profit centers. There's something they want to do, think they should do, and so they're trying to find ways to make a lot of money to be able to do it. I think it is, I don't think, at least for the initial human voyages back to the moon, on to Mars, are going to be led by governments. The private sector will partner, will provide equipment, but the private sector has always provided equipment. I mean, NASA's never built a spacecraft. Or at least a human spacecraft. They've all been done by private industry under contract with NASA.
I think that's a very interesting point. And it has always seemed that way to me, where I believe Lockheed Martin and those companies have been making their rockets forever. But it wasn't until the 1983-84 with that legislation from Reagan, where we've kind of said that the commercial space industry had begun, or it was.
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of reasons for that. And again, as you have done, but others may want to do, read the book, Ronald Reagan and the Space Frontier. But there were lots of people in the late 70s, early 80s, that began to perceive space as a place where you could do what you wanted to do. There have always been space nerds that wanted to build space hardware, but that perception was linked to, you could do what you wanted to do and make money at it. And the Reagan administration was very pro-business and bought that argument, and so began to set up the regulations, set up the policies, to try to foster the commercial sector. I think they were three decades premature. Nothing really happened out of all these commercial initiatives. And the other thing that was going on was a decision to stop the production of the expendable vehicles that the government was using in favor of the shuttle. The shuttle was going to launch all government payloads. So here they were fully, jargon word, amortized. I mean, fully paid for Delta rockets, Atlas rockets, Titan rockets. And people said, hey, we could launch commercial fare-paying satellites using those rockets and make a business out of it. And so there was the start of the commercial launch business during the Reagan years. But again, the first commercially licensed launch was in 1989, was after Reagan left office. So Reagan laid the seed of a commercial space sector, but the seed took a while to germinate.
Yeah. And I think Reagan also had his famous Star Wars initiative, which was, well, I believe that it was basically a bluff to bankrupt the Soviet Union, like force them to expend money they did not have. But that was a military initiative. That was an anti-satellite initiative. And I did not know that the shuttles had anti-satellite capabilities. But I'm
think of the shuttle repairing the Hubble Space Telescope. Hmm. If it could go up and grab Hubble, it could go up and grab anything, at least in an orbit that it could reach.
How is it possible? So today, this is more contemporary, but today we have the Space Force, and Russia has been believed to be testing anti-satellite missiles. And don't those two things go against the Outer Space Treaty of 1972?
Unfortunately, no.
Really?
The Outer Space Treaty prohibits the deployment of weapons of mass destruction in orbit or on celestial bodies, but only weapons of mass destruction. So a killer satellite that would destroy an intelligence satellite is not mass destruction. It's artillery, basically. So there is no set of prohibitions against the development or deployment of space weapons. A lot of people think that there should be, hope that there can be, and it's again an issue for the incoming administration, whether they try to negotiate some sort of international agreements, maybe treaties, maybe guidelines, maybe standards of behavior that limit the weaponization of space. Space is fully militarized, but it's not fully weaponized yet. And indeed, Russia last week tested an ASAT weapon. China has developed that capability. It would be naive to think that the United States has not also done some development of counter space, anti-satellite capability. Because satellites are so important to our security, if you're going to fight a war, the intent is to win. And if you're going to win a war, dealing with the opponent's adversaries, space capabilities are an important element of that. So, you know, people don't very much like to talk about this, but there could be an arms race in space, but it's not too late to stop it.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I did not think about the difference between militarization and weaponization, but that's a very good point because, I mean, it obviously started off as a race to the moon, but it was the arms race and it was the space race and it was against the Soviet Union. It was the Cold War.
But going on in parallel with that were the developments of military communication satellites, observation satellites, early warning satellites, global positioning system. It's a military system. GPS is owned and operated, I guess now, by the Space Force for the last year. I think yesterday was the first anniversary of the Space Force. And it's the military has been owning and operating space systems since 1958. They don't like talking about it. Some of the capabilities are highly classified. Some are out in the open, so that you can find the information if you want to. But I'll be a little cavalier and say people like you, real space enthusiasts, don't spend much time thinking about that dimension of space activity because it's not exciting. It's not sending people to distant destinations. It's kind of nastiness, force against force.
Yeah, and I I mean, I think you're correct. It's not as grand, but I do think it's very interesting, and it's obviously very important, because a lot of things, when we go out into space, a lot of things, everything will follow us, policy and people and ideologies, they'll all follow us out there. So we'll have to
if anybody is interested in pursuing down this line, there is an organization that does a really good job on these issues. It's called the Secure World Foundation. Small group of people, Secure World Foundation. They have a website. You can search for them. And they are very actively involved, as the name suggests, in trying to keep space free from those activities that would make it less secure. So they're a good group to become familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a question. This kind of goes back to the beginning of what we were talking about, but we were talking about the, 1957 and everything. And way back when, John F. Kennedy, he offered to cooperate with the Soviet Union to go to the moon. And why was it that Khrushchev refused? And why did JFK offer the cooperation? Was it because we were so behind? Or was it because he truly wanted to cooperate?
It's a good opportunity for commercials. It's a complicated story, which is spelled out in John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon, the first of these series of presidential books. Kennedy actually three times suggested cooperation, each with different motivations. He was part of a group in the late 50s in Cambridge, mainly MIT and Harvard folks, that developed the idea of something called arms control as opposed to disarmament. And the idea was to keep military activities from spreading into new environments, among other things. That's arms control. And so he said in his inaugural address, to the Soviet Union, let us explore the stars together. He made an initial initiative. This was well before he decided, 4 months before he decided the U.S. had to go to the moon. So his initial bias was to cooperate, even though the United States at that point was way behind in many space areas. All right. Then he had Yuri Gagarin. Then Kennedy decided in the immediate aftermath that we had to compete. And if we were going to compete, we had to win. And so he chose the moon as something we could do before the Soviet Union. But he was very worried about the costs of that. He asked in his speech announcing his decision to go to the moon, he said, if we're not willing to bear the cost, we shouldn't start. He was very sensitive to the cost. And so he floated something to Khrushchev in the one and only face-to-face meeting they had June 3rd and 4th. And so 2 weeks after his We Should Go to the Moon speech, he met with Khrushchev in Vienna. And at the lunches, he kind of informally, but it was planned in advance, said, why don't we go to the moon together? And Khrushchev, first day, said, maybe. And then Khrushchev consulted overnight with his advisors, and they said, we have a very weak basis for our space program. We've got a good rocket that we can do things. We haven't decided whether we're going to the moon or not yet. And what cooperation would do was reveal our weakness. And so when Kennedy raised the idea the next day at lunch, Khrushchev said, no, not without complete disarmament, which is basically a showstopper. All right, fast forward 2 years, 2+ years. The United States had begun to be serious. We were beginning the Gemini program. We had more cards to play on the table. The United States had convinced the Soviet Union to withdraw its missiles from Cuba in October of 1962. Kennedy enunciated what he called a new strategy for peace in a commencement address at American University in June of 1963. His first initiative was a limited test ban treaty, and the idea of space cooperation was the next initiative. And so he went to the UN in September of 63 and said, why should it be a race? Why not do it together? And Khrushchev apparently thought, man, maybe we should. But then Kennedy was killed. And with him, that initiative, that impetus, Lyndon Johnson was not interested in cooperation, the new president. The head of NASA, Jim Webb, was not interested in cooperation. So it never came to fruition. But it's interesting to say, you know, alternate history. What if Kennedy had lived? What if Khrushchev had stayed in office? What might have happened? We'll never know.
That is very interesting. And I think that it's very important to know what's going on behind the scenes and how these different situations, like the vision of power, is so important. And especially in the United States now, we pride ourselves on being leaders in space. And do you think that's an important thing? Is it important that the United States itself is the leader in space? Or would it be better if the European Space Agency was leader in space, or for the world, I suppose?
Well, I think something that people don't quite realize is that the United States spends on civilian space, no, on space overall, the United States spends more than the rest of the world combined. Yeah. So over 50% of all space spending, government space spending in the world, comes from the United States. If we're not in a leading position spending all that money, then you have to say, well, what's the problem? And in many areas, we are not the leader, and there are problems. So I think the fact of leadership itself is less important than what we do to make full use of space capabilities, which results in being in a leading position. You don't do it in order to be the leader. It's because you do it that you are the leader. So I think leading through accomplishment, and some of that accomplishment can be done in cooperation with the rest of the world. There's no reason to repeat Apollo as a unilateral demonstration of leadership. In today's world, I think working as we are on the space station, on almost all of our robotic space missions, working with other countries is the right way to go into the future.
Interesting. And if I am correct, you are a part of the Planetary Society, is that right?
That's true. I'm a member of the board of directors.
Fantastic. And then, so what is your goal as part of the board of the Planetary Society?
Well, I mean, the society's goal is to be the largest and most effective space advocacy group in the world. And the three priorities we advocate are for robotic and human exploration of the solar system, planets, and in general, but particularly the solar system, the search for life on other worlds, and planetary defense, defending this planet against asteroids or comets. So those are the three focus areas for the Planetary Society, trying to get people excited, to come up with ideas, to work with government, to point out values and payoffs from a vibrant program of planetary exploration and planetary defense, to work with people who are doing, and I don't know whether you've been paying attention, right? As we talk, there have been some unexplained signals from a nearby star that, people are trying to figure out, is that a communication of some sort from another intelligence? Planetary Society has funded a number of so-called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence initiatives. And there's still in orbit, a thing called LightSail, which is a demonstration of a way for planetary exploration using the wind, the particles that come off of the sun to wind against a large sail to send spacecraft long distances, not in a big hurry, but it's basically kind of free energy.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
So that's the sort of things we do.
And so my question about the planetary defense is, would that require, or is that a possibility for weaponizing space technically in defense of Earth itself?
It was a deep concern of one of the founders of the society, Carl Sagan, of using the Bruce Willis scenario of using some sort of nuclear weapon to deflect an incoming asteroid. One of the areas where the society is active is looking for various, first of all, you got to identify these things. We don't know where they all are, and we keep getting surprises of sizable objects appearing kind of without warning. So we have to find out where they are, and then have to figure out what are the alternatives if you see something on a trajectory that would bring it into collision with the Earth. What are the options for deflecting an incoming object? And nuclear is one of them, but it's not the only one. And clearly, it would be good to have ready some deflection system that has very limited threat elements to it, other than making sure that we are able to deflect an incoming object. So I don't think worrying about planetary defense is a slippery slope towards weaponization.
Gotcha. I think the fictionalization of Armageddon is interesting to segue us into a little bit of science fiction.
In all the Star Wars movies, yeah, people say, well, what is a space force? Is it going to end up with a bunch of Millennium Falcons? And now they have a name. The troops of the Space Force are going to be called Guardians. As of 2 days ago, that was announced. So there are images in science fiction. I know you wanted to ask me about science fiction. I've never read science fiction. It's influenced lots of people in the space business, and I'm not one of them.
That's very interesting. I think you're not alone necessarily in that way of thinking, where we've asked a couple of scientists, I've asked them if science fiction, or what their favorite science fiction book is, or if they believe science fiction is important for space exploration. I think it's interesting that not all of them have had that same influence. And I think that's...
Yeah, but, contrary example is Elon Musk. He clearly is familiar with a trilogy called Red Mars, Green, Blue Mars, Green Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson. And his image of what he wants to do on Mars is basically terraforming. And clearly some of those ideas came from science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of those ideas are important for someone to try to flesh out. And I think it's very cool that they try to build on those, what was science fiction, and try to make them reality. And I think that's, in my opinion, it's important for space exploration.
Yeah, the only problem is most science fiction is kind of dystopian. Most science fiction ends up with people getting killed or...
That is true.
Civilizations being destroyed. there's not a lot of happy endings in science fiction.
No, yeah, I just finished up The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and it basically ends with the moon colony throwing rocks back at Earth. So
right.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out too well, but you know. Well, Professor, I have one more question for you. And it would be, how do we inspire the younger generation to get involved in future space exploration? I think that part of what the Planetary Society does is a good way of going about it. But I want to hear your personal opinion.
Well, I think it's give them an opportunity to get involved. You know, with the development in recent years of CubeSats and NanoSats, the lowering of cost of access to space, the various programs that let high school or college students build and launch and operate satellites. So I think, you know, providing hands-on opportunities to do things in space gets people excited. And so the more of that, the better. Then there are a wide range of groups, space camps, various STEM organizations that try to stimulate both as a way of increasing the technical literacy of this country, which we badly need, and to build a support base for future space activities. So there's lots of stuff out there to be discovered if people take the first step to look for it.
Fantastic. I couldn't agree more. Actually, you brought me to one more question. How do people get involved like you got involved without STEM and in different scenarios like that? Like, I'm a history major. How do I get involved?
Well, NASA has an active history program. Find out about it. See if there are opportunities to contribute. One more commercial. Non-technical people, come to the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University for master's degrees in space policy and history. And that leads them in many cases to very rewarding and interesting careers. There are places like ours, Space Policy Institute at GW. There's a thing called the International Space University based in Strasbourg, France. And there are a couple of other programs around the world. There's Space Law, McGill University, Leiden University in the Netherlands. There are places with people without technical backgrounds that want to get involved, not just as a side gig, but as their career path. There are a lot of opportunities to get started in that direction.
Fantastic. That's a lot of good advice. Well, Professor, we are coming to the end of our interview. Do you have any final comments, words of wisdom for everyone?
Oh, I'm not good at that. And it's been a pleasure talking with you. It's a pleasure dealing with people who are not only enthusiastic, but knowledgeable. And aren't we lucky that we've gotten involved in this particular area of human activity, which has astronauts, has images of the cosmos, has discoveries, has revolutionized human life. I think the space sector is one of the best things that humanity has done. And so I'm very gratified that I've spent a career working with it.
We're definitely happy you did. It's been an honor talking to you. It's been an absolute pleasure to hear what you have to say and listen about your experiences and everything. And we couldn't agree with you more. Space is the best thing humanity has done, or one of the best things. I'll speak for myself. But okay. Professor, right. Thank you so much. And everybody, check us out on Instagram. You can find out more about Professor Logsdon on his website, which is easy to find if you look up his name, Google his name. It's right in the Wikipedia. And tune in again next week. And remember to keep looking up. How you know, man?